Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, Protect Our NHS. We're joined with some campaigners who are trying to save the NHS from privatisation, and The Bristolian, Bristol's satirical privatised style newspaper. And our next stop, of course, on the tour of the universe with Paul Fernie too. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. But we start by looking at the National Health Service, and I'm joined by two campaigners from Protect Our NHS this evening, Mike Chappell and Steve Timmins. Hi and welcome to Dialect.
Hi.
Hello.
First of all, and it's up to you who answers this one, is it the NHS actually being privatised or not?
It's Mike Campbell, Tony. The NHS has been being privatised for the last few years. I think that the campaign that we've set up in Bristol is really trying to educate people on the marketisation of the NHS. What I mean by that is the selling off of services to the private sector.
So it isn't actually being privatised. What's happening is the private sector is being allowed to bid for parts of it.
It's privatisation. If you take a company like Harmony, who are running the 111 service, that is a privatised service. The fact that it's got NHS logos on the letterheading and on the service centre doesn't mean that it's not privatised. It is being privatised.
Well, that's interesting. Harmony is in the news, isn't it? This 111 service. Let's talk about that. What is happening with this 111 service? It doesn't seem to be going very well. Harmony is a horrid name for something that actually isn't working when people phone up.
And in fact, it stands for Harrow Medics Out of Hours Network Incorporated.
So who are that? Is
right.
that a company?
Well, Harmony was set up in the a number of years ago by a group of GPs in London who ran the out-of-hours service in North London. Harmony then were bought out for £48 million by UK Care, or Care UK, last November. And Harmony won the contract to deliver most of the 111 services across the country. So, for example, in Bristol, the NHS Direct does not deliver now the emergency services. That's the non-emergency service. It's run by 111, and that is Harmony. So Harmony is the company that is running the local service in Bristol, North Somerset, and Bath. And as you know, there's been a number of problems.
Well, the idea is, of course, this is going to cut costs. Isn't that the point?
This is Steve. Yes, it is supposed to cut costs, but it's just highly unlikely that it will. I mean, Harmony, the people who are now answering the phones aren't properly trained, and therefore you're getting too many people now having to rush into A&E because they don't know quite what to do. And you've got to remember now that Harmony has been taken over, as Mike said, by Care UK. Care UK has also taken over hospitals like Emerson's Green, because that was owned by UK Specialist Hospitals, which had been bought out by an American company, which is now being bought out by Care UK, which is largely owned by a private equity company called Bridgepoint. And that's what it comes to. It. These guys don't do anything for nothing. And if you think it's cheaper, I think basically we're all deluding ourselves.
OK, now, the idea of changing things in this way is almost inevitable, isn't it, when we're suffering with the economic situation as it is at the moment, Mike?
We have got to change the situation somehow. And I think that the main changes that we're looking to in our local campaigning is going to the local clinical commissioning groups and questioning them about the contracts being awarded to the private sector.
OK, so are these the new groups that are being set up with doctors supposedly managing
absolutely.
These budgets? Now, is that going to work?
It remains to be seen. Already, the British Medical Journal has said that the Tory policies around the current reforms has the support of only 15% of GPs, and there are a number of GPs who are very unhappy about the recent reforms. And it's really important that people understand that the clinical commissioning groups, and we have one in Bristol, one in North Somerset and one in South Gloucestershire, are the groups who are going to be putting out to tender the local health services.
But, I mean, surely doctors actually do want to do this. I would have thought that they would be quite interested, Steve, in having some sort of choice about which services are commissioned. Because at the end of the day, they are sending patients to one service or another. They want to have a say.
Well, yes. I mean, I think originally that's what they all hoped for. But two things on that. One, because of the what they call the Section 75 regulations that the government sneaked through after the 2012 Act had come in, it meant that every single service has to be put out to tender. And if it's not, and there's a private company that's rich enough, they can sue. And that's going to cost the NHS a fortune. The other thing is that GPs thought they had the power, and they thought they would have the power to commission. But turns out they don't.
Well, that sounds a bit strange. I mean, you know, they thought they could commission, but they don't. Why is that?
Because so much of what's happening is being instructed from on high, if you like, from the Department of Health. And the GPs themselves that sit on the clinical commissioning groups. All right, take a tender. In Bristol, the key thing that's happening is for the first year, the only recommissioning is going to be mental health services. I mean, we as a group, Protect Our NHS, think it's appalling that people can make profit out of mental illness. And remember, one in four people in this country will at some time in their life experience mental illness. And the doctors, they're not experienced in mental health issues. They have some experience of it and some knowledge of it. Therefore, where are they going to get their advice? Where are they going to get their expertise?
Well, they may have to bring in expensive consultants and this kind of thing to get advice and to steer them in the right direction.
And I think one of the important issues here is that the people who are going to make a lot of money out of the marketisation of the NHS are the accountants, they're the lawyers, they're the backroom men and women who, in fact, make money out of administration. It's not going to lead to a cheaper NHS or a cheaper health service. And I'm going to start avoiding calling it a national health service because, actually, at the moment, we have a very fragmented healthcare provision in this country. And unless people wake up to actually what is happening, to realise that these large companies, whether it's Virgin Care, Serco, Care UK we've just talked about, Ramsay Healthcare, the Circle, who run the hospital in Bath, unless people wake up to what's happening, we are sleepwalking ourselves into a US type of healthcare provision.
So what does it mean, this marketisation?
Basically, it means that the clinical commissioning groups have to put out to tender any service that is being delivered within locally for health. What that means essentially is that large companies who have got lots of financial backing can actually put in bids whereby the lowest bid wins. It may not be the best bid, but the lowest bid wins. And we've seen already Harmony won these contracts to deliver the 111 service last year. And in North Somerset, there's been a whistleblower who has said that they're running the 111 service at dangerous levels. In Bath, they've had to delay the start of the 111 service until June because Harmony are not up and ready yet.
So why wasn't NHS Direct able to just carry on? Because it was a fairly reasonable service, wasn't it, compared to this new one?
Steve and I, and hundreds of us in Bristol and North Somerset, are beginning to understand that there are two issues behind this. One is it's about money. If you realise that of the lords who voted for Section 75 regulation, that hundreds of those lords have vested health interests or interests in the private healthcare industry, then it's very clear that people have vested interest in making money out of the health. The second thing is that there is a lot of evidence, and you can pick it up on the web and from various reports, that this government has an ideological opposition to public service.
Well, that's a bit strange, because we need public service, quite clearly we need it, whether that is something like the BBC, whether it's the fire service, whether it's the police. The idea of selling these out to the highest bidder, I mean, that's a lunatic idea. Steve, can I just ask you, what drew you to the campaign? What is it that, you know, sort of got you interested in spending some of, you know, your time, your valuable free time, on Protect Our NHS?
I think anger. I mean, actually, rage. I mean, I was so appalled. I mean, I was born in 1950, so I'm getting on. And I grew up in the National Health Service. I'd be dead without the National Health Service. I had a serious accident on a motorbike. I was seriously ill. I had pleurisy when I was a child. And these people have got the nerve to make us start to pay, and not just make us start to pay, to take money out of the service for private profit. I'm so angry. It just, you know.
Professionally, what's your background?
Background is in the media. I mean, you mentioned the BBC. I used to work for the BBC for a long time, BBC in Bristol. And what maybe people, you know, if you look at the news coverage, it's appalling. I mean, every press release that comes out of Number 10 is reported. Tell me when you last watched or listened to a news programme when it didn't start or have somewhere in it a report from David Cameron says this or that. It is just not being analysed and thought about. Everyone, take Stafford. Most of the serious statistical analysis says that it was not 400 to 1,200 people who died there. It's just wrong, but no one cares because it's a damn good headline.
Well, it was. There were some serious problems there.
There were very serious problems.
One of the problems that, I mean, I've picked up on is the chap who was in charge at Stafford being then promoted and made like, the head of administration in the health service.
Again, you see, that's slightly unfair. He was there for 6 months in an interim post. It's just not, you know, he was there. He was not, if you like, one of the guilty party. I suspect the guilty parties are this whole managerial class that was originally brought in under the Thatcher government and then under Tony Blair. I think that's the real problem.
Now, so, you know, one of the best things to do with your anger is to steer it in a positive direction, Steve. So what would you like to see happen now?
I think that what we have to try and do, what we want to try and do, is to keep working actively at grassroots. We talked about the clinical commissioning groups and why GPs wanted to do what they wanted to do. In North Somerset, the lay chairperson of North Somerset CCG is a consultant to Capita Simmons, a private company. We have to fight these conflicts of interest when we see them. We have to continually question what all these commissioning groups are doing, and we have to monitor the tenders. And I think that if we can do that, if everybody listening goes to their GP and says, what's going on? Please tell me what's going on, because I don't want the NHS to be privatised. That would have a groundswell.
Now,
that's what we're after.
You've just pointed out there something which is really often known as the revolving doors syndrome, where you have somebody who's in one of the companies that stands to gain suddenly becoming chair of the organisation that is dishing out contracts. And then, of course, after a couple of years of dishing out the right contracts, this person very often finds himself back on another board of another big company that's getting the contracts. Mike, this doesn't sound like a very good way to
run
things.
Let's take a real example. And we've already talked about Care UK. Care UK runs more than 50 primary care services and 6 hospitals in the country. The board of Care UK have backgrounds in a whole range of private companies, Wellcome Foundation, PLC, a largest producer of tea globally, the Cheshire Building Society, Centrica PLC, who runs British Gas. Now, that's been a successful privatised service, you know, the privatisation of gas.
And also, of course, they are now in the situation where they just put up the gas prices as much as they can get away with each year.
Now, I want to go back to Care UK.
All right.
Care UK recently lured a top civil servant from the Department of Health, a guy called Jim Easton, who actually oversaw the NHS 111 procurement service.
Shouldn't be involved.
Well, he's now Care UK's managing director. It's the revolving door also from government and Department of Health into these private companies.
You know, it sounds to me like the G4S syndrome applied to healthcare could be a total disaster. Steve?
Well, can I just very quickly say, well, you know that the South West Ambulance Service, which covers the whole of the southwest of England, including our own area, will from October be run by the people who run national car parks.
Gracious alive. Mike, I asked Steve a minute ago, what was it that brought you in to protect our NHS?
Well, I was receiving emails from an internet group called 38 Degrees, and saw that they were interested in having a campaign to influence clinical commissioning groups. Like Steve, I'm angry. My daughter's children, my grandchildren were born in the States, and my daughter was horrified to get an invoice when she had her 2 children for staying in the hospital. She had to produce a healthcare insurance certificate before her husband was taken off in an ambulance to hospital.
This is what happens in the US, is it? If you phone up for an ambulance, the ambulance will turn up, but they won't take you away unless you've got some...
They want to know, are you insured? And believe me, Tony, there will be a many, many people in this country over the next 5 to 10 years who will be saying we need to get health insurance. And that is going to that. It's when that happens that people will start to sit up and take notice. Unfortunately, I fear that might be too late. This is why I'm trying to get involved in campaigning locally now.
Locally, we've got two big NHS trusts, haven't we? We've got the North Bristol NHS Trust, which is South Mead and French Hay Hospitals. Plus, they've, you know, often these places have got little units nearby as well. Then we've got the University Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust in the city centre, which is the BRI, what used to be Bristol General Hospital, which has now been sold off for luxury flats. I'm not quite sure how much money was made out of that sale, whether it was enough to keep things going, and whether that's really what the NHS is for, selling its buildings off for luxury flats. But what are your thoughts about that? Because one of the things I've noticed is we've got in charge of the chairman of the Central Bristol Trust, that is University Hospitals Bristol, is John Savage, who's a former master of the Merchant Venturers. We've also got Peter Rillett running the North Bristol Trust as chairman, and he is also a merchant venturer. This looks like the old great and the good, the old slave traders from the Bristol's past that are in charge of this billion, and they are about £500 million each, these budgets, aren't they?
I think you know, there is a whole discussion to be had here about the role of merchant venturers in Bristol, which we've not had for a number of years. But yes, it's worth saying that if you've got chairs of local trusts who are basically businessmen with connections into the business world, and Peter Rillett, I don't know him personally, but it's very, you can look on the web and find out about him. He's got connections with KPMG, one of the largest accountants in the world, a company that has been criticised for its advice around tax avoidance.
Well, he was in charge of Bristol's KPMG office, apparently.
Well,
I don't know if you know, but KPMG are under investigation for all sorts of crimes. One is the Competition Commission are looking at their price fixing over the last 10 years, along with the other big four accountancy firms. We had a couple of weeks ago, one of KPMG's partners in the United States prosecuted for selling confidential client details for bags of cash and Rolex watches. I mean, this is KPMG.
Well,
and also, of course, they signed off the accounts of some of these big banks in the run-up to the 2008 crash,
absolutely,
saying everything's healthy.
Absolutely.
HBOS, they said, was entirely healthy, and of course it wasn't. So Lloyds are now considering prosecuting KPMG for basically providing false information about how viable that company was. So KPMG are not squeaky clean by any means.
No, and look at KPMG and the healthcare link. If you look at the team, the executive board of Monitor, and that's the national body that oversees all trust work, you'll see KPMG, McKinsey, Pricewaterhouse have pretty much got the whole board sewn up. And there's a whole nother issue here, Tony, which is the link between these large companies and tax avoidance. If you just do a little bit of research, and Steve and I, we're learning something every day.
Oh, yeah.
You read that these large health providers like Care UK, linked to Bridgepoint, Ramsay Healthcare, The Circle, have all got tax avoidance mechanisms built into their finances. So this money that is being spent on patients, this is NHS money, is also going out of the NHS, the publicly owned NHS, into the privately owned NHS, and then out of this country as well, because a lot of these companies have global links.
OK, Mike, we've heard a lot from you about Bristol, but what about your professional background?
My background is health and social care.
And what were you doing give us an idea of some of the things you were doing in your career.
Well, I was a probation officer for 25 years, so worked with offenders. And in passing, that's another a public body that is in the throes of being privatised and being taken over by G4S, Serco and Capita and others.
It's almost like a garage sale, isn't it? The government is putting all this stuff out on the street and saying, anyone want to make us an offer for it?
You know, I remember when the water board, the gas board, I'm old enough, I'm slightly older than
that
Steve.
That was the 80s, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And dentistry was, you know, you got free dental treatment. The largest dental care company in this country, Oasis Healthcare, has just been taken over by Bridgepoint. Now, we've just been talking about Bridgepoint, who have a very large stakehold in Care UK. So it is the gradual privatisation of all public services.
Well, something that shocked me that's been in the news this week, Steve, is the idea that Western General Hospital, I think it's called, is up for grabs. Anyone can come along and buy it. If you've got enough money, you can bid to run the place. So this seems to be like one of the first instances I've seen of a very overt privatisation when the contracts to run a hospital are up for grabs.
Yes, it really is very worrying, because Western General, it's a difficult area in North Somerset. It's very underfunded. It's got a lot of poverty, rural and town poverty. And I think you will see already that one of our group went down there to visit someone. He's a volunteer driver. And he saw that they'd moved the A&E department out of the centre of the hospital into a kind of little annex. And the reason that Western General is being sold is it costs a lot of money to run it, because if you have an A&E department, you have to have ancillary departments around it, x-rays and that.
Well, they're under a lot of pressure. I mean, this is a side issue in a way, but a lot of other types of health services aren't working, including this 111 service. Yes. So they're finding a massive extra weight of people are turning up at A&E saying, help me.
Yes. Well, I mean, that is the trouble. And I desperately hope, and we are going to try and fight at our hardest with everybody we can in the whole of North Somerset and Bristol, to stop Western General being sold off rather, to one of these profit-making companies. If it becomes part of United Hospitals Trust here or North Bristol, that would be terrific. But it means that if it does and they close A&E, if you're a parent with a very, very seriously sick child, you've got a half-hour drive to get to your child into hospital.
This seems to be, in a way, a kind of subtext to a lot of these types of privatisation, is it's actually making our votes mean less. When we're, when the government is running something, at least we know that the politicians are in some way in control of that. As soon as something gets privatised, the politicians just hold up their hands and they say, if things go wrong, and they say, well, sorry, guys, nothing to do with us.
Yes, they blame them. And if you look at the disinformation being put out at the moment about the NHS, all these attacks on it all the time, it's disgraceful. I mean, it's largely dishonest. And yet, if you look at the television schedules, how many programmes, documentaries have you got on now? Midwives, 24 Hours on A&E, dramas like Holby City, Casualty. We love the NHS. We love the way that we're cared for. There's a few complaints, and nothing's ever perfect. But selling it off to the lowest bidder, isn't it, Mike? Mm-hmm. It's just disastrous.
Mike, we did hear, didn't we, before the general election, David Cameron say there would be no top-down organisation of the National Health Service.
That's a laugh, isn't it? Before Cameron came into power, he talked about lobbyists lobbying. He said, and I'll quote, he said, "We know how it works, the lunches, the hospitality, the quiet word in your ear, the ex-ministers and the ex-advisors for hire. We can't go on like this." And you know, he's just started to employ a lobbyist called Nick Seddon, who is a health advisor. And his last role was Deputy Director of Reform, which is a free market think tank extensively funded by healthcare and insurance companies. So, Tony, we know the direction that we're going in. Steve and I are sufficiently angry to try and do something about this and educate people. And it's great to be on the programme. But we do need to be active locally as well.
So how do you get active? I mean, what do? Go along to meetings of the various trusts? Whereabouts are these decisions being made?
I think there are two or three things people can do. One, as Steve has already said, is go to your local GP. Get involved in your local practice. I think Jeff mentioned this last week. Get involved in your local practice patient group. Go onto our website, send us an email, give us a ring.
Do you meet fairly regularly?
We meet every two weeks. We're trying to keep
fortnightly.
Whereabouts?
In Bristol.
We're meeting at the moment in the Robin Hood down.
Pub. Yes, it's pub. A pub. We always meet in a pub,
and it's St Michael's Hill. And we get up to, we have up to 20, 25 people, but we've also got hundreds of people on an email group list as well, and we're very happy to add other names to that.
Okay, so if you can't manage to make it into Bristol for one of the meetings, you can stay in touch.
Absolutely.
Okay, now I mentioned the two big trusts. The big controversial one, I think it's probably fair to say, Mike, is the North Bristol Trust, because we've got a massive PFI there with the new building of Southmead Hospital being at least partly paid for by the closing down of Frenchay, which is literally got an international reputation, but it's in rather a nice village. And the land there is rather valuable to luxury housing developers.
Well, they're
it?
Talking about 350 to 400 new houses, and that's the latest information I've picked up. And there is a local campaign that is opposing that. But yes, you're absolutely right. The new Southmead Hospital has been funded through the PFI programme at a cost of around £380 to £400 million. As you know, PFI is a long... I'm trying hard to describe it. Basically, it's you pay back the money you've borrowed to the private sector, and that is taxpayers' money that's being paid back. French Air Hospital, we don't know what's going to happen to it. It's likely to disappear because it's obviously going to be in North Bristol NHS Trust's interest to sell it to reduce their costs around the PFI.
One of the things I noticed is that the Trust's finance director, who was responsible for signing all the documents to do with this PFI, last year decided he'd had enough and he left. Which is a bit worrying. If a finance director is not prepared to see one of these big PFIs through to the possible teething troubles and at least a few years into the actual use of this new building, that worries me.
And there are going to be a number of NHS trusts over the next 5 years who will go broke because of the PFI problems.
Well, we've seen that in London, haven't we? I remember, I think in South London, one went broke. We had another one, not quite sure where that was, but this is starting to happen, isn't it? That we're seeing NHS trusts actually just simply running out of money and going bankrupt.
And it won't be the private equity companies that have interest in these PFI contracts who lose. It'll be the taxpayer who loses.
It also seems to me that, in a way, this is part of the deliberate thing that's going on, where you've got lots and lots of private businesses in there, except the trust that's managing it goes bankrupt. And then, of course, the private companies can come along and snap up that trust and start taking on that role. And that really is privatisation, full-blown privatisation.
And don't forget that the decision to turn hospitals and encourage them to become trusts means you fragment the whole hospital network in this country. The original idea of a nationalised public health service was that you could have central planning, and if a hospital had been overspent, that could be... A hospital that had been underspent, you could take the money from that. At the moment, if you have a hospital that's underspent and overspent, like Western, who are in debt, then you've got real problems because you can't then recoup the money from a central pot.
Steve, tell us a little bit more about what's happening in North Somerset, because it's nice to get the rural picture as well as what's happening here in Bristol.
I don't want to sound too political, but the difference between Bristol and North Somerset is that Bristol has got councillors who are Labour, Lib Dem and Conservative. In North Somerset, it's a swathe of blue. You've got some very fine independent councillors, but it's extremely difficult for one to see through anything beyond this because it's so politically motivated. I went to the inaugural meeting of an organisation called Health Watch, which again I think Jeff mentioned last week, and certainly it's something that if people want to get involved, Health Watch is one of the places to start. And the chief executive of North Somerset Council, someone who's not an active politician, you'd think, stood up and said, well, this was a very exciting time for the NHS. This was great. After all, look at all the messes that had been made under the existing primary care trust system. And in that message, he included the measles outbreak in Swansea. Now, anyone who can consider that a measles outbreak in Swansea was the responsibility of the NHS, well, it's just insanity. And this is the problem you got there. There's... It's very disparate, lots of small villages, parish councils struggling to get their voices heard, and it's very, very difficult to see how you can change something, especially, as I said, when you've got the lay chair who is a consultant to Capita.
Well, it's nice that there's someone around to point these conflicts of interest out. I mean, isn't it actually illegal for someone who's involved with one of these big companies to sit on one of these boards?
No. I actually raised this because we had a meeting with the board.
It's a conflict of interest. Surely they have to step out of the room.
That's
if
right.
anything is...
They step
anything.
Out of the room. And I said, well, that doesn't sound very good. Oh, she said, no, you can trust us. I saw it sounds rather like the newspaper industry, with the regulation of the newspapers. And that went down like a cup of cold sick, to be honest.
OK. What about you then, Mike? You mentioned earlier on something to do with tax avoidance, I think.
Yeah, but I was just going to very quickly say that in Bristol, the Clinical Commissioning Group have listened. We've been to meetings. They are responding to questions we're asking about aspects of their work. So there has been a pretty positive response, to be honest, in Bristol compared with, I think, North
Somerset. Steve,
North
it sounds like you've got a bit of a job on your hands in North Somerset. I can also tell you, driving around North Somerset, you often find the roads are appalling. They're not looked after. It's strange, isn't it, how we've got the situation. And we had, I think it's West Somerset District Council going bankrupt, even though it's actually one of the wealthiest parts of Britain.
Yep.
You've got more owner-occupiers in West Somerset than many other parts of the country. Yep. And yet, for some reason, they're not collecting enough local council tax, and they're saying that they're bankrupt.
Yep.
Why is it, how is it, that we're in a situation where some of the wealthiest parts of the country simply cannot afford to run their roads and are having problems, obviously, in Western, even running hospitals?
Well, the wealthiest road in the village I live in is private, so maybe that explains it. We have £2 million houses not paying council tax.
Yeah, we've had North Somerset Council switching off the lights, don't they, at midnight, where a soldier was killed, I think it was in Clevedon, because the lights weren't on and he was wandering across the road and a car smashed into him. We've also had accidents where the council's not painting the white lines on the roads and not trimming the hedges. So this seems to me to be a little bit more of an extension, in a way, of this attitude of, well, we're very wealthy, but we're not going to spend any of our money on any of the local infrastructure.
Well, I think it's terribly difficult in North Somerset because it is very, very underfunded. I mean, its central government grant is very poor. As I said, I think it is the lowest funded of all the clinical commissioning groups. I may be wrong on that, but in the country. It's very, very sad because, as you rightly point out, there's an awful lot of private wealth in North Somerset.
Well, so anyone listening who's as angry as we three seem to be, what can we do to actually take part in the campaign?
Email us on protectournhs@gmail.com. That is our local email address. Jeff mentioned Keep Our NHS Public, which is the national organisation we're affiliated to. You can give Steve or I a ring as well.
Just give us your numbers, maybe twice each, because then that's for a lot of people who aren't on the internet, this is a far better way, isn't it?
Well, I think certainly for people who don't have access to the internet, just want to have a chat and find out more information. So my number, so it's Mike, is 07-891-43-224.
Just give us that number again.
07-891-43-224. And that's specially for people in Bristol.
Steve, yes. In North Somerset, how's people best contact you?
Yeah, on my mobile, 07-841-238-588. That's 07-841-238-588. Look forward to talking.
Can you just remind us whereabouts your meetings are as well?
We meet Tuesdays, and the next meeting will in fact be next Tuesday at the Robin Hood Pub on St Michael's Hill.
Lovely. Well, that's Mike Campbell from Bristol and Steve Timms from North Somerset. Protect Our NHS. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
BCFM is your community radio station, and there's something for everyone, which is why BCFM were recently voted the best small station in the Southwest. You'll hear all sorts of music, from country to jazz, classical to reggae, and a lot of Bristol music. There's kids on air, and all sorts of lifestyle and cultures are represented. We broadcast in many different languages, and cover news and views you just won't find anywhere else. BCFM is Bristol's choice. We love our city because Bristol is our community.
Well, I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos now. Jason, what do you got for us this week?
Got a rather interesting story that came up on the This Is Bristol website.
The Bristol Post online, which haven't quite got their new website going, even though it says we've got a new website. When you go onto it, it's a bit messy. It's like some internet student has been experimenting with various new types of... Anyway, we won't complain too much about it. The fundamental problem with this new website that the Bristol Post, Evening Post, have put up is that every time you click onto the next page, it looks exactly like the previous page, with loads of stories still there from the previous page. So, anyway.
Nicely done.
So this is a little bit of a conflict for the Bristol Mayor, George Ferguson.
Yes, this is a story that came up, certainly one I picked up on yesterday, may have been there a few days, I don't know. Apparently George Ferguson was less than polite to a member of the Bristol community. and indeed refused to apologise afterwards. The person in question is former UWE student Paul Saville, who was talking to him about local car parking.
Yeah, so George wasn't very polite to Paul. What was Paul asking for, Jason?
He was asking him their plans for some local car parking.
Car parking. Is this to do with residence parking or what?
That is indeed. That was indeed.
Right, because this is a real bone of contention, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
The thing is, the council, in the old days, this is back, you know, where I were a lad, you used to pay the council a little bit and they would provide all sorts of nice services like libraries, look after elderly people, people with learning difficulties, provide schools, provide all sorts of services. Now, it just seems the council provides less and less and less for your money, but what they do want to do is find all sorts of ways of generating money from us, more money, taxing us more, and one of those things is by regulating the streets and making us pay to park outside our own homes, something which obviously for years has been free. So what's Paul's point with the residence parking?
Well, Paul's obviously dead set against it, so he was asking George for information about what the plans for, whether he thought it was a good idea, and George refused to issue an apology and suggested that Miss Saville had been stalking him.
Really? Oh, well,
apparently, questioned him at recent events on the same issue.
Well, I think the thing is, if you're an activist, you do want to pursue politicians, and that's part of the job, I'm afraid, George. If you're going to be mayor, there are going to be people that want to...
Absolutely.
Not necessarily stalk you, but people that want to approach you again and again and ask you questions. That's part of being mayor. That's part of the deal. I mean, even Peter Abraham, the Conservative leader of the council, agreed the other day that actually it's a kind of dictatorship that George has got. And so he's bound to have people trying to bend his ear. And so that's essentially what this is all about, isn't it?
Yes.
Tell us a bit more about Paul. What was he up to at UWE?
Paul, I don't actually know what he studied at UWE. He was an activist. He was involved in many things. He was involved with the Free Girls Movement. He's involved with People and Planet. He was involved in the UWE occupation when we did that against
students. So he's an activist,
fees.
Isn't he? He's a student
he is an activist.
Activist. Someone
student
who's
activist.
Always bending other people's ears. We've got a copy also. I mean, you normally bring your Private Eye in, but we've got a copy this week as well of the local version of Private Eye, which is the Bristolian, the Smiter of the High and Mighty, which is the local sort of version of that. It's a kind of gossip rag. The Bristolian, you can email them at Bristolian News. That's two words run into one. BristolianNews@gmail.com. Call or text them on 07936 427 731. That's 07936 427 731. With any of your Private Eye style stories. One that's on the front page here is the threat over Doc's death. A rush to silence whistleblowers over accidental death of a cyclist that could have been avoided. Now, this is the poor chap that got his bicycle wheels caught in, I think, sort of tram lines and railway lines on Bristol Docks and ended up, it appears anyway, ended up drowning as a result. Now, this, of course, will be coming to, I imagine, to the coroner's court fairly soon. And there, City Council could well be considered liable for this, for having some kind of cycle route in such a dangerous position where cycles can get caught in the tram tracks. Actually, rather dangerous. So it could possibly be that that the coroner will find against the council in this particular case. Pretty shocking, but very good that the Bristolian is bringing it up. The one problem, of course, is we have a coroner now who some of the previous coroner staff who've been sacked and then issued with gagging orders have actually called a puppet coroner. That is to say, that the coroner, basically what happened was the city council took over the payroll for the coroner's office and then decided that they were going to, with the help of Ken Clark up at Westminster as Justice Secretary, get rid of the coroner. Now, obviously, they believed that that was perfectly fine and okay to do, and they went through the proper process. But the trouble is that the people who were sacked have been also been gagged. So that's not a very good sign when you've got a previous coroner who's been gagged.
Not really.
How independent is our coroner's service in Bristol? Well, I'll leave you listeners to work that one out for yourselves. Anyway, Jason, thanks for bringing up the thing about Paul and George. And come on, George, you can take it. If people are lobbying you, let you just get on with it. Wouldn't you say that?
Absolutely. That is part of the job of being an elected official.
Thanks, Jason.
BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on.
Now, a tour of the solar system, Paul Fernie. We're at Mars this week, so whereabouts is Mars?
Okay, Mars is the fourth planet from the Sun. It's the last of the terrestrial planets. All the planets that come after Mars are what's classed as gas giants. So the four planets closest to the Sun are all terrestrial or rocky planets.
Okay, so are we saying that the ones outside Mars are just balls of gas and there isn't any, if you're trying to stand on them, you're just going to kind of sink or what?
Basically, yeah. Yeah, there's not a lot of terra firma on the remainder of the planets. So you'd struggle to find your footing.
What about the orbit of Mars? Okay, it's just about outside Earth's, but any other interesting things about the orbit?
Yeah, the orbit of Mars is the total time is 687 days around the Sun, so it's not far off two Earth years.
Okay.
The diameter of Mars is 4,222 miles, compared to Earth's 7,926. So just over half the size of Earth, Mars is.
Okay. What about missions? We keep hearing what now. This is an ongoing discussion, isn't it, between us, really, about this business of is there actually going to be any kind of real sort of manned presence on the moon, other planets, things like that. We talked about the moon base last week. What about some kind of manned or unmanned mission to Mars?
Yeah, there's lots of talk about manned missions to Mars. And as we've sort of talked about, you know, the practicalities of it are difficult, particularly in Mars. It takes about 8 months to get there.
Boring.
And, long journey.
Play backgammon for 8 months.
How many times can you hear, are we nearly there yet, in 8 months? it's a fair old trek out to Mars.
Hopefully you don't take the kids in the back of the spaceship.
You know, needs must. You know, you've got to take something to carry on the race once you get there, because you're not really standing.
You're not coming back.
There was news recently of this Mars One company who are looking for volunteers to go up on a non-return journey to Mars in 2023. But yeah, like I say,
it's not the greatest birthday present for the kids, is it? To tell them we're going to Mars and we're not coming back, and you know, then I'm going to just hand it all over to you guys to cope with it.
I don't think that'd go down too well, especially if they just asked for a Lego set. There's been loads of missions to Mars, sort of exploration missions. The first one, which was Verena 4, which was a Russian probe, which went up in 67, is actually still in space. It's now orbiting the Sun. It's no longer active. But and then you've got the two NASA rovers, Opportunity and Spirit. Spirit, which was only sent up recently, is silent at the moment. They've lost contact with it. And Opportunity is now 3,218 miles days past its warranty. I'd hate to think how long it will take them to get the AA up there if it does break down.
Oh, dear. Now, The War of the Worlds, this fantastic H.G. Wells... the original War of the Worlds film really is pretty fantastic. I think the remakes I've not liked very much, but the book was great. Doesn't Mars feature in that, if I'm right? These invaders are from Mars?
It does indeed, yeah. H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. He based a lot of the scientific information on a publication in 1895 by Lowell. And the scientific sort of side of Mars was based on that information. Back when early observations of Mars were made, they could see like canal, dark areas, and they looked like water canals, which led the astronomers at the time to believe that Mars was inhabited, and that they had it in their mind's eye that the Martian landscape was very arid and dry, and the people there had to build these canals to transport water around. It turns out that these canals were actually optical illusions, because Mars has quite powerful dust storms at certain times of the year, and it was just optical illusion. But this obviously led to the human imagination running wild, as it does sometimes, and leading to this proposition that, you know, Mars was inhabited. H.G. Wells then sort of encapsulated that sort of idea into the War of the Worlds, and of course
I don't remember any narrow boats in the War of the Worlds.
So that's where he got the general gist from. You know, that's where this idea that Mars was inhabiting, the maybe Martians on Mars, sort of came from. And we've all heard of the 30s broadcast in America of the War of the Worlds and the mass panic it caused at the time.
Well, that was also, I mean, there's evidence, if you look up Harvey Quantrell, that this was actually part of the American military planning that as a test exercise to see what they could get away with, a psychological warfare test. So that's another aspect that a lot of people know about.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Brits did it too. We did it back in the 20s, I believe. The BBC did a mock revolution in London, which they broadcast for an hour or so on the BBC radio, not long after it first started. And people thought that there was actually a revolution going on in London and the Houses of Parliament had been burnt down. So there was a similar reaction in Britain to the War of the Worlds in the States 10 years before.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, you know, the power of the novel and the written word, and also the power of the media is still quite incredible, even now. Humans have been fascinated with Mars for many, many years, hundreds of years, in fact.
So is there any life up there? I suppose that's the ultimate question, Paul. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, they've not found any yet. They're sort of digging around for evidence of water in the past. You know, it's suspected Mars did have liquid flowing on it at some time, but they can't sort of pinpoint when that was. I mean, Mars does have ice caps, but they're carbon dioxide ice as opposed to water ice.
I suppose once we get any kind of stable, civilised life on Earth, then we can start thinking about possibly finding some on Mars.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, we should concern ourselves more with what we do down here before we go spreading ourselves around the universe.
Okay, next week it's going to be...
Next week we're going to cover an unknown sort of area between Mars and Jupiter, which is the asteroid belt, which is where a lot of sort of the asteroids that sort of threaten our existence come from.
Okay, so don't hang around there too much. You could get clunked on the head rather hard, I would
absolutely
imagine.
Absolutely.
All right, Paul, look forward to that next week.
And goodbye.
BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on.
It's the What's On Guide, Jeff Sparks.
Hello, this is What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 17th of May, Bleak will be performing with support from Holding Tides and Alien Stash Tent at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Also on 17th of May, Urban Folk Quartet will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 each and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present The Iguanas. This was a high school band which formed in Michigan, USA in the early 1960s and featured a musician who started his career as a drummer. I'm of course talking about Jim Osterberg, aka Iggy Pop. This is The Iguanas with the song Again and Again. The song Again and Again. Moving into Saturday, 18th of May, the Mod Fathers will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 19th of May, 10 Cent Toy, Cruelty Circuit, 4th Autumn, Wibistu and Adam Feezy and the Hellcats will all be performing at the Stag and Hounds in Old Market, Bristol. Entry is £5 on the door and doors open at 7 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guests, particularly those from Protect Our NHS. That was Mike Campbell and Steve Timmins. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733 and you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline 01454 318 753. That was Dialect and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Goodbye till next week.
reddened sky was lit by green flashes, cylinder following cylinder, and no one and nothing was left now to fight them. The Earth belonged to the Martians.